Hey, this is Kent here at MindChange, and we will be having a Q&R episode coming up soon. We'd love to respond to your questions in this audience-driven episode, so please send them to podcast@mindchange.com. When you send in your questions, please attach an audio recording of it, stating your name, where you are from, and then clearly asking your question for us. Please also transcribe your question in written form on the email when you send it in. We look forward to hearing from you.
Today's topic is one that is widely misunderstood, heavily medicated, and often feared by those who don't understand it. Bipolar disorder, also known as manic depression. But this episode isn't about pathologizing you. It's about asking the deeper questions that many health professionals never explore. What if bipolar isn't a brain malfunction? What if it's an intelligent, subconscious response to emotional and environmental chaos? One that's trying to communicate the pain, contradictions, and unmet needs that your conscious mind has learned to ignore. Welcome to the Mind Change Podcast. I'm your host, Heather McKean, speaker and author of the bestseller, Mind Change, and creator of the Mind Change Method. Out of the ashes of my own healing journey, I became an armchair expert in the mind-body connection and the neurobiology of trauma. Using the methods we will discuss on this podcast, we have helped countless people transform issues that previously seemed impossible to overcome. Each week, we'll dive deep into the strategies, insights, and success stories that will inspire and equip you to harness the power of your mind, body, and spirit in order to create the life of your dreams. Together, we are changing the world, one mind at a time. Welcome back to the Mind Change Podcast. I'm your host, Heather McKean. If you're loving these episodes, please take a moment to like, subscribe, and leave a review. It really helps this work reach more people. So let's talk about what is bipolar disorder. Bipolar disorder is characterized as alternating periods of elevated mood, mania or hypomania, and depressive episodes. These mood shifts can be extreme and disruptive to daily life. There are two main types. Bipolar 1 usually involves severe manic episodes, often requiring hospitalization, along with depressive episodes. Bipolar 2 is defined by less intense hypomanic episodes, alternating with major depression. Now, it's often more difficult to diagnose because the hypomanic periods can appear as high functioning or even productive. According to the National Institute of Mental Health, approximately 2.8% of U.S. adults have bipolar disorder. But some researchers suggest these numbers may be underreported due to stigma or misdiagnosis. The mind change lens asks, instead of what's wrong with the brain, we ask what happened to this person. What emotional blueprint was laid down in childhood? What subconscious beliefs are the mind still trying to resolve or protect against? From this view, bipolar symptoms are not necessarily a disorder. They're a strategy that the subconscious has developed to survive perceived threat, emotional dissonance, or systemic invalidation. Let's begin with what we often see in early development among clients who later exhibit bipolar symptoms. So here are a few of the common childhood emotional drivers. The first one is unpredictable or chaotic environments. Many people experience emotionally volatile caregivers. One moment they can seem nurturing, and the next moment enraged or withdrawn. This kind of inconsistency wires the brain and the nervous system to oscillate between heightened state of vigilance, which is mania, and collapse, which also might look like depression. It becomes a survival strategy. Another common driver is suppression of emotional expression. So in households where big feelings were punished, ignored, or mocked, children often learn to suppress their authentic emotional experience. But those emotions and the energy behind it doesn't disappear. It builds. The result? Explosive manic phases followed by deep emotional depletion. Another common environmental contributor is abuse and boundary violations in childhood. So these would be children who grew up in homes where there was a long-term emotional, physical, and or sexual abuse. In these cases, the subconscious learns to use anger and rage as protective boundaries when real boundaries were unavailable. Mania may function as a shield or a fight response. Another common childhood driver would be over-responsibility and early role confusion. So some people grow up in homes where they are expected to emotionally regulate their parents or take on adult responsibilities too soon. This can be in situations where possibly contributed to a divorce. So if there's a divorce early and the parent with primary custody or sole custody may feel like there's too much of a burden, or there may be financial distress, or they just need more help. And therefore, one or more of the children become kind of like the adult, the second adult in the home. It might be if you have grown up in a family where there is a history of mental illness within the family. And this is where we start to hear that these things are often genetic. And I would say in that way, they are epigenetic, that very frequently a child who is raised in a home where there is a mentally unwell caregiver or multiple unwell people in the home, mentally unwell, then that creates internalized pressure and confusion around the child's identity and self-worth. So it's not uncommon for those with bipolar diagnoses to feel chronically disoriented about who they are or what they want or what role or purpose that they might have in the world. And this would be mimicking or repeating the behaviors that they saw in the adults in their primary caregiver situation, or at least in their surrounding environment. Another common driver is neglect, loss, or early abandonment. According to the work of a Dr. Alan Shore in Effective Neuroscience, disruptions in early attachment and emotional mirroring can dysregulate the development of affect regulation systems. So without safe co-regulating, internal extremes become the norm. So you may know, or have at least heard on one of these podcast episodes, that children are not born with the ability to self-regulate. They learn self-regulation over time by co-regulating to an adult. So to co-regulate means they regulate to the regulation or dysregulation of an adult. So even an adult doing the best that they have at the time, if they're severely dysregulated in their body, in their nervous system, in their emotions, in their emotional intelligence, then the child regulates to that. So regulating to dysregulation. And so what happens is in the early development of the child's regulation systems, there becomes extremes. So extreme highs and extreme lows that become the norm and don't get grown out of because they were never modeled how to age out of feeling those really extreme emotional variances. So for children, emotional variances, extreme variations in emotions are actually very normal. And they're doing this to kind of learn their boundaries of the higher and lower range. But when that isn't done within safe co-regulation with a regulated adult, those extremes never learn to become within a safe norm. And so we see that very commonly in people who are doing bipolar disorder later in life. These and many other childhood blueprints often evolve into specific behavioral and emotional patterns in adulthood. So here are a few common adult manifestations we see with someone who is doing bipolar. There will be explosive anger and verbal defense mechanisms. As one client shared, "I use rage like armor." Many report using anger as a way to create space or assert control, especially when feeling emotionally invaded. The anger often mimics how boundaries were modeled in childhood, aggressively or erratically. Another adult manifestation is someone who has very high highs and very low lows. These cycles mirror the internal reality of someone who feels chronically disempowered, but periodically tries to reclaim control through overdrive, perfectionism, or grandiosity, followed by the crash of hopelessness, self-doubt, and shame. Often verbal flooding or emotional shutdown might be present. Many people struggle to articulate their needs until emotions become overwhelming. Then communication comes out as intensity or complete withdrawal. This often reflects a subconscious fear that if I ask for what I need, I'll be hurt, rejected, or abandoned. Another adult manifestation is deep distrust and control patterns. This usually is due to betrayal trauma and family instability. They often result in a subconscious belief such as no one can be trusted, or if I'm not in control, I'll be destroyed. Mania becomes the subconscious mind's attempt to outrun helplessness or terror. There's more than likely a lot of self-blame and shame present when someone is doing bipolar disorder later in life. And that's because in childhood, many of these people were blamed or shamed for what was labeled maybe as their emotional sensitivity or their emotional reactivity. As a result, they internalized the idea that their feelings were too much or bad. And for little people, they don't often yet have the brain hardware or the prefrontal cortex development to understand that it's that their feelings are labeled too much or bad. They really just then internalize that as I am too much or I am bad. And the resulting shame from that and those belief systems can fuel both depressive spirals and then the compulsion to prove their worth through overperformance, which might mimic a mania episode. So there are many subconscious patterns that drive bipolar symptoms, but the brain is not broken. It's brilliant. It's executing a survival algorithm based on the data it's received. Here are some subconscious beliefs that often show up. If I lose control, I'll be hurt. If I rest, I'll fall apart. No one will love me unless I'm impressive. My needs are dangerous. I have to fight to be seen. These kind of belief statements and many more create that subconscious oscillation between overexertion and collapse, hypercontrol and despair, overgiving and then complete withdrawal. See, this is not dysfunction. It's a reflection of unresolved trauma loops. There's a psychiatrist named Dr. Nasir Gahim who has written extensively about how bipolar disorder may be an adaptation of temperament rather than a disease. In his book, A First-Rate Madness, he points out that some people with bipolar tendencies possess traits such as resilience, empathy, creativity, and deep intuition, especially in the areas of leadership and crisis. Dr. Kay Redfield Jamison, herself diagnosed with bipolar 1, has also highlighted the creative and intuitive aspects of manic states. In her book, Touched with Fire, she acknowledges the immense pain in the depressive cycles that follow. Dr. Jamison goes on to say, when we are manic, we often believe we are finally our true selves, but the cost of that belief can be devastating. Before moving on, now might be a good time to talk about the most widely accepted and administered treatments for bipolar, which is pharmaceutical medication. At Mind Change, we are not anti-medication. We operate from the belief that medication can sometimes be a bridge, but it's important that we address a difficult truth. Conventional psychiatric medications, SSRIs, antipsychotics, and mood stabilizers can and often do more harm than good, especially in children and adolescents whose emotional and cognitive systems are still developing. SSRIs, commonly referred to as antidepressants, have a known risk of manic switching in youth. Multiple studies have shown that SSRIs can precipitate manic or hypomanic episodes in individuals predisposed to bipolar patterns. Dr. David Healy, psychiatrist and author of Pharmageddon, has spoken extensively about the dangers of antidepressants triggering mood destabilization. He says SSRIs can trigger manic episodes, particularly in children and adolescents. This effect is often misdiagnosed as emerging bipolar disorder, which then leads to further polypharmacy. This can lead to a diagnostic cascade where more and more and more medications are added, further obscuring the original emotional drivers or the original call for help or communication that the body is doing in some of these bipolar type episodes. Another difficult thing that emerges from pharmacology as an approach to treat bipolar disorder is something called tardive dysmorphia. And it's really just another word for long-term emotional numbing. Dr. Rif L. Malik, professor of psychiatry at the University of Louisville, coined the term tardive dysmorphia to describe a condition in which long-term use of antidepressants leads to chronic treatment-resistant depressive states. In his 2011 paper in Medical Hypothesis, he writes, prolonged antidepressant treatment may induce a chronic depressive state that worsens the long-term outcome of mood disorders. Neuroplastic processes may underlie the evolution of this treatment-resistant state. This is consistent with reports from clients who say they feel numb, emotionally blunted, or flat, even when no longer experiencing acute depression. A 2022 systematic review published in Patient Preference and Adherence found that nearly 45% of SSRI users experienced significant emotional blunting, often described as not being able to feel love, joy, or sadness. Dr. Paul Andrews, evolutionary psychologist and SSRI researcher, has this to say. While SSRIs may reduce the severity of depression, they may also dull a person's ability to feel basic human emotions, which could impede emotional healing. This emotional shutdown directly contradicts the mind change philosophy, which aims to reconnect clients to the messages within their emotions, not to mute them. Another side effect of pharmacology for these kind of disorders is a proven increased suicide risk in youth. The FDA has issued black box warning for SSRIs, citing increased risk of suicidal ideation and behavior in children and adolescents. In fact, Dr. Joanna Moncrief, psychiatrist and author of The Myth of the Chemical Cure, points out, we have yet to see convincing evidence that SSRIs reduce suicide risk in young people. On the contrary, the data points to a worrying link between SSRI use and suicidal behavior. So there's heavy costs for the use of antipsychotics and mood stabilizers. It's very common to see people who are doing many mental disorders, but especially bipolar, that they are using antipsychotics along with SSRIs and sometimes benzos and another cocktail of different pharmacology drugs that are supposed to be helping these people with their symptoms. And sometimes antipsychotics are actually diagnosed very quickly to young people simply for what is called mood stabilization. So even when psychosis isn't present, they are being given antipsychotic medications. According to Dr. Grace Jackson, psychiatrist and author of Drug-Induced Dementia, second-generation antipsychotics were marketed as safer alternatives. But in reality, they carry serious metabolic and cognitive side effects, especially for children whose brains are still maturing. There are many risks beyond what I've already spoken about to using pharmacology to deal with the messages from the body, many like obesity and long-term insulin resistance, sedation, cognitive dulling, slowed processing, withdrawal difficulties, dependency or addictions. Even the drug lithium, while being reported to be a standard treatment for many people with mental health disorders and bipolar disorders, that requires constant blood monitoring due to its narrow therapeutic window and potential thyroid and kidney toxicity. And crucially, none of these medications actually resolve the underlying traumas, beliefs, or subconscious strategies that may be driving the bipolar patterns to begin with. In fact, they may dampen symptoms, but they do not decode or release the root cause. Through the mind change lens, suppression does not equal resolution. Medications may quiet symptoms, but they often delay the deeper emotional integration the body and brain are asking for. In fact, side effects can mimic or worsen the original problem. A lot of clients report worsening anxiety, blunted emotions, and even deeper depressive episodes, along with suicidal ideation after extended pharmaceutical use. In children, emotional development is interrupted. When a child's developing mind is medicated rather than understood, so many of them end up internalizing the message that they are broken rather than simply misunderstood or might have unprocessed emotions. By the time a client finally reaches us, they've often spent years, sometimes decades, on a pharmaceutical roller coaster. They've cycled through a cacophony of mind-altering chemicals, endured countless side effects, and still feel no closer to peace. For many, the original message that their mind and body was trying to communicate has been buried so deeply under diagnoses and drugs that it can feel nearly impossible to find their way back. But I can tell you, with the right tools and support, that clarity and healing is absolutely possible. How do I know that? Because I was diagnosed at 16 as manic depressive bipolar. So at 16 years old, I was taken in. And I go through this in the book, Mind Change. But I was taken in to deal with the fact that I was feeling depressed. At 16, the condition of my family life at the time and extenuating circumstances, being brought up in a single mother home, the child of addicts, having an abusive stepfather, having there been sexual trauma and verbal trauma and physical trauma through abuse. By the time I'm 16, I was not asked a single thing about my history, not one thing. And I wouldn't have known to speak up any differently about it because to me at 16, that was normal. Most of my family members were on some form of psychiatric medication. And so it seemed the inevitable outcome. So I received my diagnosis at 16 as being bipolar, manic depressive, and was started on my first of many SSRIs. Again, not being asked at all about my circumstances or my history. And so that started a long battle with going on and off and different medications and sharing and exchanging different psychiatric medications, along with SSRIs of various sorts, and then benzos. And so I was told that this was due to the finding through blood work of a chemical imbalance. It is way too much information for this particular podcast episode, but it has been categorically proven that this idea of a chemical imbalance being able to be seen on any sort of blood work or really any sort of metric is a fallacy. It isn't true. It's never been true. And yet, we can still find this being taught in some medical schools. Not because it was ever true, not that there is a single study out there that has proven that, but because that was the narrative that had been passed down through pharmacology, doctors, as a way of giving evidence of why these kind of drugs should be used. It is not true. Look it up yourself. You can find a lot of great stuff about it. And if you have more questions, let me know and we can eventually do a full episode on that. I do go into great detail about that in my live events, in our weekend workshops where we focus on mental health and anxiety and depression. You see, Mind Change focuses on helping individuals uncover, resolve, and rewire the original subconscious drivers of bipolar patterns without relying on lifelong sedation. It has been probably close to 25 years that I have taken anything for any sort of mental health diagnosis. And I can tell you that I do not associate with the former diagnosis of bipolar or manic depressive at all. And so do I think I was misdiagnosed? Yes, absolutely. But so are so many others. I did fit a lot of the boxes and ticked a lot of the boxes that would have led to that diagnosis originally. But again, nobody asked about what was happening at home. So rather than treating the brain as broken, I learned that it was actually brilliantly adaptive. When we honor the signals that it gives, or the symptoms that it gives, as calls to go deeper and not shut down, that's when everything changes. We do this by identifying how this condition might be serving the individual at some level. As you probably know from a mind change perspective, every condition, even the painful ones, often serves a hidden purpose. We refer to these as secondary gains. So a few possible secondary gains for bipolar are the fact that mania may function as protection from despair. Depression might be the body's attempt to slow us down so that we don't burn out because we've been in a very hypervigilant state of survival. Long term, that is so, so hard on the body. So the body and the mind may be actually depressing the feel-good chemicals because we aren't thinking about good things. We're not feeling good things. We're not in good situations. And rather than dealing with our thoughts, we are going specifically off of, oh, I must be depressed because I'm feeling this way. There can also be extreme emotional swings. So very high highs and very low lows, like we talked about before. And that can often be a signal of the belief systems, the body, the mind saying, help me. I can't regulate this alone. And I will tell you, that's a young, young voice that is often coming from a childhood where you felt like there was nobody safe or nobody sane to reach out, to regulate to be of help when you needed it the most. So these patterns, these secondary gains are not bad. They were adaptive. It's once protective. But yes, over time, those protective mechanisms might become and often become destructive. So what does mania protect you from feeling? These might be some good questions to reflect on if you or someone you know is doing bipolar disorder. So what might that mania be protecting you from feeling? On the contrary, what does depression allow you to avoid? Who modeled emotional extremes in your life? What are you afraid would happen if you were calm, clear, and seen? What belief system are you still subconsciously trying to prove or disprove? The truth is, you're not broken. You don't need fixing. But your subconscious mind might still be running outdated protection programs, and they can feel crazy. And they can feel severe. So we're not saying that the feelings aren't real or the episodes aren't real. We're just looking at maybe some of the contributors that haven't been explored before. That's the work of mind change, going inward to identify, rewire, and resolve the emotional drivers that the conscious mind can't always access. If you're ready to stop fighting your own mind and start listening to what it's trying to tell you, we're here to support you. Myself and many other clients are actually really good examples of how this can be resolved once and for all. If this episode resonated with you, you might be wondering, okay, that's great, but what's the next step? How about this? Give us a call. We invite you to schedule a free consultation. And when you call in, you're going to get to speak to one of us, one of the founders. In just 20 minutes, we may be able to help you identify the most personalized next step for you on your healing journey. We have many different options to help meet people where they're at. Okay, that's it for this episode. Thank you again for joining us on the Mind Change Podcast. We look forward to seeing you every week where we are changing the world, one mind at a time. Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Mind Change Podcast. We hope that you found the insights and inspiration shared today valuable in your own journey of personal growth. Please be sure to subscribe to our podcast, or if you're watching us on YouTube, please like and follow us there. And we would really appreciate it if you would leave us a 5-star rating and review. It has measurable impact on how well we're able to reach others and continue to produce more free content to share. But mostly, thank you for taking this time as an opportunity to invest in yourself. Until next time, let's keep changing the world one mind at a time.